What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. This is Resistance in Residence, where we profile artists using their gifts to change the world. This week's Resistance in Residence artist is Bay Area multi-hyphenated artist Ashley Smiley. Hello, Ashley. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi.
I've actually heard you do that hi in several interviews as I was preparing for us to chat today. All right, Ashley. Well, this is where I get. So y'all, I've known Ashley Smiley. Well, those of us who know and love her call her Smiley. Known you for a couple of years now. But I want to learn, we are all going to learn way more about you today. And I want to start with like where and how you grew up and what your family was like.
I'm a born and raised San Franciscan, Black San Franciscan. Just, you know, shout out to us because we don't be existing no more. We's a small group. But I am an only child raised by a single mother. So, you know, that life. My dad's in the military. He recently retired. He retired a few years ago, but he was in the military and that was a whole special situation. I was really blessed, to be honest. Like I've got a certain level of privilege, not necessarily in like the financial whatever, but just having a single mother who absolutely positively just supported everything that I wanted to do, you know, aside from making sure I went to the best schools and had the best education and socialization. Like my mom never said I couldn't do anything. Like she still hasn't. Like if I walked in to my mom's room right now, I was like, you know what, mom, I think I want to be an astrophysicist. She'd be like, oh, well, what did you pay all that money for school to do that for? But let's go, you know, let's figure it out. I know you're weak in math, so let's get that together. But yeah, you know, and then just being, you know, Black in San Francisco and growing up, and it was a different time. It's weird to only be 35 and be talking about the good old days of San Francisco, but there were good old days even for myself. And just grew up. I don't know what else to say.
It's all right. I got more questions for you. I actually want to stick on this, right? The Black San Franciscan far and few between. I mean, when I started, I started organizing in the Bay around 2009, and then you're younger than me, but you may or may not remember 2015 was a particularly bloody time period, both for the SFPD and for OPD. Both departments murdered more people that year than they had for several years prior. And so there was a lot of organizing that was happening, you know, back and forth across the Bay. And there was a group of Black San Franciscans that popped up, dope organizers, the last 3%, because it's about 3% of y'all left. And that was in 2015. You think that has held, or you think there's less now?
We're still about the, oh, actually we're less than that. I think we're closer to the 2% or might be splitting in the middle, but, yeah, we haven't grown, you know, we haven't grown.
And then how has that changing demographic and the pull to the right in San Francisco impacted quality of life for Black folks in San Francisco?
It's trash. I'm trying to figure out like the more articulate way to say it, but it's really just, you know, Black San Franciscans are really trying to step out, be seen, be heard, and not just be seen like, you know, we're on the Instagram or whatever, but really be visible and have more opportunities to be visible. But it's really difficult. I think, you know, populations change in a city no matter what. It happens, and it's not that, it's not necessarily special, but I think it's what has prompted those changes and the way that it's happened, right? Like it's not, you know, a natural ebb and flow. It is literally people coming in from outside of California. You know, they're not even coming from different parts of California. They're coming from different states with a level of wealth that we just really haven't seen. But also, it's the closest thing to colonization that I think I've ever experienced, like in real time, because it's people who aren't coming in from even different parts of California. They're coming from out of state with this level of income and wealth and privilege and also individualization that we've never seen. And they come in, they kind of take residence, and then they go back to wherever they want to. So they're not investing in San Francisco. They're not investing in what was before. They're just coming in and sweeping stuff out of the way. And because San Francisco's always leaned towards the dollar, like we're not going to lie, San Francisco's always leaned towards the dollar, this huge thing to appease all of these new people has been wild, because it's been an active pushing out of Black San Franciscans in particular, and from these different Black communities and folks of color also, and Black creatives. You know, so many Black creatives are not able to live in the place where they do the majority of their work. And so now they're being spread further and further out. And it's a horrible feeling, because we're already Black in America, which already means that our level of grounding is shaky. Yes, we have connections to the motherland, but that's rife with its own problems, right? And so a lot of us who have, you know, set our roots down in San Francisco, that's who we are. We're San Franciscans, and we're Black San Franciscans, and that's where we've held down our whole identity. And so then to be pushed out and kind of, you know, it's like blowing on a dandelion, you know what I mean? Now we're just like floating all in the air, all over the place, and trying to get back. But it's been horrible, the way schools are shutting down, the way homes are disappearing, the way, I mean, it's just
the way Black dog walkers are being attacked and their house burned down.
My goodness. And it, and that has been the craziest thing in the world to see, because I'm like, you want to talk, the other stuff has been, you know, weird financial conservative, you know, neo Nazi political stuff. But this, that, that instance right there, this situation that's happening with this Black man in Alamo Square, like, is the most Klan stuff I've ever seen. And I was like, and it's right at, when we talk about in the heart of San Francisco, like that area is literally the heart of San Francisco. And they've just recently had to have like this huge park rally, like, keep him safe. And right after this whole keep him safe, this doesn't make any sense, this man has gotten, you know, effigies and all these other things into his house, and now his house has been burnt down. And I'm like, and that is what used to happen to us when we used to move into widespread. I mean, that's what.
Yeah. And as an artist, as someone who understands the power of narrative, one of the things about, you know, this incident, which I'm sure will be relevant no matter what time of year we air this interview, this incident, watching people tie it back, right, to some of the racist so-called journalists, right, across these platforms that have literally built followings of thousands of people, right, some in San Francisco, some not, that has really fostered, right, this anti-Blackness. And so for a lot of us, it's no surprise that this has led to violence. And yes, talk a little bit about that. Talk about the power of narrative and why who's controlling that narrative matters in terms of the quality of life.
You know, it's such a multi-part thing, right? The San Francisco's always been a place of smoke and mirrors, always. I know this as a native. We've never told the truth about ourselves, period. And people peep that. And, you know, we deal with it however we deal with it. But this particular situation is so devastating, because what we have is, you know, this influx of people who are not from here. They're able to pay to change the narrative, right? They can put the dollars behind who says what. But we also have a Black mayor who, instead of being able to be a first Black female mayor and all this other stuff is really at the mercy of these people who have these dollars, right? And so her job is to have a narrative that works for the people who are coming here to spend money, for the people who are already here to keep their money here. And that doesn't necessarily always jive with what the Black and POC folks need her to say. But then if you go to like one of her rallies, then she's like, let me tell you the truth, right? And this is how I really feel. And so everyone is feeling like their hands are tied, their tongues are tied, and what has been able to make it through all of that is this mishmash narrative of like, San Francisco, home of technology, we've got the money, we've got all of these condos that you can be in that no one else can afford because they're made for you to come from outside and they're not made for the people who live here because none of us can afford to live here because the actual poverty line of San Francisco is $130,000 or something like that, which is not a poverty line at all. But we have that. And then we also have, let's talk about all the things that are going wrong in San Francisco. We have had opioid crisis in San Francisco for a very long time, but now, because of these new people and the new money they're bringing in, now it's a problem. But now it's not a problem that we want to deal with. It's a problem that we want to shame people for and say, get rid of them. Like, we'll put money to these people are down to put money in, not to rehabilitate people, not to deal with the actual reasons why people are self-medicating and involving themselves with these substances, or why they're living in tents, because people don't understand that a lot of the people that are living in these tents in San Francisco have full-time jobs.
Listen, and we're formally housed. Let's tell the truth today.
Like, they are legitimately waking up every morning. You are passing them on the street while they walk into a building, sit at a desk, work for 8 hours, and then go home in a tent because they cannot afford to live in any of the San Francisco housing. Because the poverty line is $130,000, that means that people making $100,000 or whatever qualify for programs for lower income people, which means that they can get in there and do so they no one has to change any, you know what I mean? They're just, and then you have Black folks who are like, we're here, we're still here, we're right here, and they're seen as complaining or being separatists or, you know, shouting for no reason. And it's just been, or even now, like when people are creating street art for, you know, supporting the Palestinian movement, all of a sudden it's seen as anti-Semitic. And it's not. And the artist is very clear that they're not anti-Semitic, but they are trying to call attention to something that is happening in Palestine. But it's these things, right? It's brand new conversations about the identity of San Francisco. Everyone always felt like they knew what San Francisco was, but even I, as a San Franciscan right now, I'm like, who are we really? Is this really who we are? This actually might be the truth, you know, and like sitting with that reality too, like what we're seeing in San Francisco might actually be the truth. Like, if you look through San Francisco history, this might actually be the most truthful version of ourselves we've ever seen. And so what does that mean, right? You know, how we were actually living in a dream state this whole time about what we thought this progressive city was about and what we thought were rooted in it. But as we can see, nothing is sacred and nothing is rooted and nothing is held together. And so now there's a fight to figure out what this narrative is. And to be honest, it makes me really excited and grateful for social media, because that's the only way that our voices are getting out there, is through like various people who are on Instagram and, whatever that app is called that's been named multiple times that we don't even want to talk about because don't nobody need to be on it. But those platforms and even TikTok are the ways that we can get our stories out, because There's still a lot of gatekeeping when it comes to our actual media sources.
Well, I did this all backwards because normally I start with the art and I hop right into the politics. So I do want to spend time talking about you as an artist. One of the things I say a lot, Ashley, is that I wish I had, so I wish I'd paid attention during practicums, right? So my father was the first Black stagehand in Las Vegas. The guy that ran the shop at, you know, my college, UNLV, was a union buddy. So while everybody else, right, had to do light, sound, all the stuff, like I ushered for like six semesters. and it wasn't until, you know, I was older, I was like, man, if I had like paid attention to lights or really paid attention, you know, to stage manager, like I could have like worked year round in the whether I got cast as an actor or not, I could just be in my home. That appears, at least from the outside, the life that you have crafted for yourself. You stage manage, you production manage, you're a playwright. You do all of the things. All of the things. So talk to us about finding the theater and how you became a human of all trades inside of this craft. The craft of the theater.
The theater. You know, my mom will tell you that I've always been a performer of some sort. I've always been doing something. And initially, when I was younger, my intention was to be an attorney. And one of the things that they tell you when you're, you know, moving towards being an attorney, and I mean, I was serious. Like, I interned at the DA's office. I was actually accepted to USF as a part of their 3+4 program before I decided that I wanted to struggle as an artist. But when you're going to law school and when you're into that field, a lot of times they will actually encourage you to get into theater. Because if you can persuade an audience, you can persuade a courtroom. The creative writing, the breath control, all of those things are necessary because ultimately a courtroom is a stage full of monologues and soliloquies and dialogue, right? And so that felt like a natural thing. One, because I was always in love with theater. I had a huge thing for Shakespeare until I realized that he was not the only person in the world.
I want to talk about that. I also, Shakespeare is a love, indeed.
Yeah. And I loved it mostly because he was, you know, a crap talker. And I had a really great class with Paul Flores when I was at USF, and we actually talked about how much Shakespeare is a part of like hip hop and hip hop theater. And I was like, yeah, I think he would have actually dug it. And he would have probably asked people to stop doing the same thing over and over and over again with his work. But that's a totally different conversation. I got into it in fifth grade. I, you know, was in the Pirates of Penzance, and I was the major general. So I was already doing colorblind, genderblind casting. and really was into it. One, because, you know, it's never a bad thing to like stand up on a stage and have a bunch of people clap for you. Never a bad thing. But also just the skills that I was learning and the confidence that I was able to gain in myself in doing that work. I was like, oh, this is something that people should really do. And then when I got to high school, I got two really awesome things that happened. One, my ninth grade English teacher took me to see my first ever Campo Santo show, which was Faye in the Desert, and it was starring Margot Hall, and it had all the people who I love in it. But I went and I saw that show, and I went, oh my God, people of color doing theater like this, like, oh, I can do this. Like, this is the theater I want to be a part of. I don't know. I'm not really a big musical person. Or whatever. Like, I didn't even realize that Disney musicals were musicals until somebody told me. I was like, these are just movies with songs. What? didn't even know that that was a thing. And so I did that. But then also I started working with a group called Colored Ink at Brava Theater Company under the mentorship and the guidance of Javier Reyes. And that was awesome because not only were we learning the fundamentals, you know, upstage, downstage, you know, centered, you know, exit stage left, or the mechanics of stuff, But we actually were devising original pieces, and we were a hip hop theater troupe. So we had a live DJ who's doing his thing, and that was our sound design in a lot of ways. And then we were going out and we were figuring out things that were pertinent to our community: teenage prostitution, gun violence, environmental justice, things like that, and creating original work about that. So now I'm learning about writing, and I'm learning about directing. I'm learning about how you put a piece together. How do you look for a cast, right? What are you really looking for? And I was doing all that, and I was having fun being an actor. And one of the arts administrators that was at Bravo was like, yeah, that's super cute, but I think you really need to learn about tech. I think you actually need to learn how to learn some respect for that part of the world. And so I learned about sound design, and I learned about stage management. I went, oh, this is really epic. You know, I really appreciate this. And through that, I actually got connected to the University of San Francisco. And because I had those skills, they were like, well, you come here, you automatically have a job, right? Because you understand how to use this equipment, and you got trained by someone who's connected to us. And I was like, oh, well, here we go. And I just started actually focusing on stage management and production management. And because, of course, you're working with theater, and theater likes to exploit you by saying that they're educating you and offering you more opportunities, you become not only the stage manager, but like maybe you're the sound designer, maybe you're the light board operator, maybe you're the this. Or you're doing all three of those at the same time. And I actually really enjoyed that. But at the same time, I was watching all these other people who were being performers and hearing all of their horror stories and seeing how they were treated. And that's not how I was being treated in tech. Now, that's not to say that being a Black girl in tech was easy, but I also got away easy because I have a very soothing voice. Especially when I was younger, it sounded much more aligned with the cream colored folks, and so they felt safer. My name is Ashley Smiley, you know what I mean? And I have a safe face. And so I was also able to navigate into spaces that other Black people who were doing tech wasn't necessarily getting the opportunity to do. And between seeing what was happening to my friends and colleagues on stage and being like, well, I don't want to be slave number two. I don't want to be the crazy Caribbean voodoo woman. I want to be in these other things. And all of my friends were saying that wasn't working for them. And then being in these other spaces, I was like, let me lean in on tech. So, you know, really just started doing that. And like you had mentioned, it's a year round thing. I could do it whenever I wanted to do it, however I wanted to do it, and work with multiple people, work in multiple places. And so that just became my official hustle. Yeah.
All right. The clock is ticking on me. We got two more things that we have to cover. The first is, so tech is your official hustle. That allows you to do many other things, including being an amazing writer. You just had the national premiere of your show. Now I'm connecting right the beginning of our conversation to the arts conversation. Dirty white Teslas make me sad. I just want to tell you, every time I see a Tesla smiling, because any color Tesla makes me sad. But every time I see a Tesla, I think of you. Talk Yay. To us about Dirty White Teslas Make You Sad and theater as a, you know, a tool for social commentary. But you got to do it like 90 seconds.
Yeah. Okay. let me get my thoughts together. You know, the beautiful thing about Dirty White Teslas Make Me Sad is that it's a multi-hyphenate conversation, right? The idea of the Tesla representing the wealth that was coming in, right? And not just and the white Tesla in particular, because it was the first thing that was hitting the scene and it felt like an invasion onto the streets, but also representing the wealth, this technology, this thing that San Francisco was all about. But if you look in a Tesla, it's hollow. And that's also what San Francisco was becoming, a hollow shell underneath all this gloss. But also I found out that there are MDMA pills with Tesla symbols on them, and they're actually very dangerous. And so how is that connecting to our opioid crisis and fentanyl and people dying on the street at the same time that they're waiting for a car, at the same time other people are waiting for a car to be delivered? And so it was really beautiful to do this story about San Francisco, about a Black, an Afro-Latino girl who's grown up in San Francisco, seen the changes, and is trying to hustle her way through the city and touching on these different things, but also having a real spiritual crisis. And the crisis is coming from feeling so unseen, unheard, unloved from the city that she has built her whole life around. Trying to have a conversation with God about it and realizing that God is not the person she wants answers from, but instead she wants answers from her city. And sometimes waiting for answers like that or trying to get answers like that will kill you. So, it was really beautiful. I got to do it with Campo Santo, my family. I got to do it at the Magic Theater, which is a huge deal for a young, emerging Black playwright to do. And it was all sparked from a conversation that I had with my mom as we were, as many Black San Franciscans do, in leaving the city and going home across the bridge. We saw a dirty white Tesla, and I was like, dirty white Teslas make me sad for all of these reasons. And she was like, oh, that might be something. So shout out to moms.
You said something there with segues. Hello, I can use words. Segues me to the question I want to talk about that I can't actually end this interview without. I'm saying, you said that, you know, the character in Dirty White Teslas is looking to God for answers. Smiley, you are getting a degree in theology. First of all, you've got like 8,000 degrees, but you're getting another one in theology?
Yes.
Say more.
I am currently finishing up my third year as a PhD student at the Graduate Theological Union. So officially, my department is the Historical and Cultural Studies in Religion, and I have a concentration in art and religion. And it's really just me talking about God out loud in my art. And also, you know, trying to, I have caught the spirit more in the theater than I have in a church. And so looking at the way that theaters and theater and, you know, Campo Santo in particular are different theaters that are made for holding conversations about spiritual connection and communication, is really what I'm focused on. But yeah, me and God go way back. So we're putting a ring on it, making it official with this PhD thing.
Smiley, you're so amazing. I can't wait to continue to watch you explode into the American, shoot, global theater scene, all of the things that you bring. If folks want to, and I'm sure they will, know more about your work and you and where you're going to be and when, where can they go to follow you?
You know what? I have been living my best life on Instagram. That is the most common place. So if you want to hit me up, you can go to Smiley, S-M-I-L-E-Y, from, F-R-O-M, the, T-H-E, SCO, S-C-O. So Smiley from the SCO is where you could find me. Follow me on Instagram, and then that'll link you to everything else I'm doing.
Fabulous. Fabulous. You all have been listening to Law and Disorder. I am your host, Kat Brooks, and we have been in conversation with Ashley Smiley, this week's Resistance in Residence artist, a Bay Area-based multi-hyphenated artist. Thank you so much for joining us, Ashley.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA, that's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. Our Resistance in Residence theme music was composed by Jesse Strauss. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listeners.
If you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.